34. Voice Prints. Nobody wanted to work on Sunday, free staff included. They drifted in listlessly, avoiding the normal weekday crush on the buses, and tried to arrange things so that they could get through to 6 p.m. undisturbed. But that Sunday proved more hectic than any weekday. At about 10 a.m., three very long, very streamlined cars drove up to the main gates. The watch saluted. The cars drove through the gates, past Spiridon, the red-headed yardman, who stood broom in hand peering at them, then rolled over snow-free gravel paths to the main entrance of the Institute. High-ranking officers issued from all three cars, epaulets flashing, and without waiting for anyone to meet them, went right upstairs to Yakonov's office on the third floor. No one managed to get a good look at them. The rumour went around some of the laboratories that Minister Abakumov had arrived in person, accompanied by 8 generals. In other laboratories, people went on sitting quietly, unaware of the impending storm. The rumour was half true. Deputy Minister Selivanovsky had arrived, accompanied by 4 generals. But something unprecedented had happened. Engineer Colonel Yakonov was not yet at work. The frightened duty officer, swiftly pushing in the drawer in which he had been furtively reading a detective story, phoned Yakonov at home, then reported to the deputy minister that Colonel Yakonov had been in bed with a heart attack, but was getting dressed and coming in. Meanwhile, Yakonov's deputy, Major Reutmann, a lean man with a tailored tunic, struggling to straighten the sword belt that sat so awkwardly on him and stumbling over the strip of carpet, he was very nearsighted, hurried in from the acoustics laboratory and presented himself to his superiors. He had been in such a hurry not only because regulations demanded it, but also to defend the interests of the opposition party in the Institute which he led. Yakonov always tried to squeeze him out of conversations with higher authority. Reutmann already knew the full story of Priantchikov's nocturnal outing, and was eager to convince the High Commission that the situation with the scrambler was not so hopeless as that, for instance, with the speech clipper. Although only 30, Reutmann had already won a Stalin Prize, and he fearlessly exposed his laboratory to visitations from on high. He had perhaps 10 listeners, of whom 2 more or less understood the technicalities. The others simply preserved a dignified silence. Askalupov, however, had sent for Mamurin, who appeared shortly after Reutmann, livid and stammering with rage in standing up for the clipper, which was, he said, nearly ready to be put into production. Shortly afterward, Yakonov also turned up, with bags under his sunken eyes and a bluish tinge in his bloodless face, and sank onto a chair by the wall. The conversation became fragmentary and confused, and before long nobody had any idea how to salvage the doomed enterprise. As bad luck would have it, the heart of the Institute and the conscience of the Institute, Operations Officer Comrade Shikin and Party Organizer Comrade Stepanov, had given way that Sunday morning to a perfectly natural temptation to stay away from work and leave the collective that they managed on weekdays to look after itself. Behavior all the more pardonable because, as everybody knows, if the proper party educational and organizational measures have been implemented, participation of managerial personnel in the work process is by no means essential. Alarm and an acute awareness of his unexpected responsibility gripped the duty officer. At some risk to himself, he abandoned the telephones and hurried around the laboratories, informing their heads in a whisper that extraordinarily important guests had arrived in order to make them redouble their vigilance. He was so flustered and in such a hurry to get back to his telephones that he ignored the locked door of the design office and had no time to look in at the vacuum laboratory, where Clara Makarigina was on duty and none of the other free workers had appeared. The heads of laboratories in turn made no public announcements. You couldn't openly ask people to pretend to be working because the brass had arrived, but went around the workplaces warning everybody individually in an embarrassed whisper. The whole Institute, then, was at a standstill, waiting for the bosses. After a hurried conference, some of the visitors remained in Yakonov's office, and others made for number 7, while only Selivanovsky accompanied Major Reutmann down to the acoustics laboratory. To dodge this new chore, Yakonov had recommended acoustics as a convenient base for the execution of Ryumin's commission.
But how do you expect to identify the man?
Selivanovsky asked as they went along. Reutemann had first heard of the commission 5 minutes ago, and so had no thoughts on the matter. Askolupov had done the thinking for him the night before, when he thoughtlessly undertook the task. All the same, Reutemann's mind had been busy in the last 5 minutes. He addressed the deputy minister informally and with no trace of civility. "Look," he said, "we have a visible speech device for recording speech visually. It prints off what we call voice prints, and there's a man by the name of Rubin who can read them."
"A prisoner?"
"Yes, senior lecturer in philology. Just lately I've had him working on the detection of individual speech peculiarities, and I hope that by voice printing this telephone message and comparing the results with the voice prints of the suspects—" Selivanovsky looked doubtful.
"We will have to get Abakumov's approval for this philologist."
"You mean security clearance?"
"Yes."
Meanwhile, although they all knew in the acoustics laboratory that the brass had arrived, they simply could not overcome the numbing inertia of idleness. They made a show of activity, rummaging in drawers containing valves, scanning diagrams in magazines, gaping at the view from the window. Among the free employees, the younger women huddled together, gossiping in whispers, and Reutemann's assistant tried to break it up. Simochka, luckily for her, was not at work. She was making up for the extra day she had put in, and so was spared the torment of seeing Nerzhin all dressed up and radiant, in anticipation of his meeting with the woman who had first claim on him. Nerzhin felt as though it was his birthday. He looked in at the acoustics laboratory for the third time, not because he had any business there, but because waiting for the long-overdue police truck made him restless and nervous. He did not sit on his own chair, but on the window ledge, inhaling the smoke of a cigarette with enjoyment and listening to Rubin. Having failed to find in Professor Chelnov an appreciative audience for the ballad on Moses, Rubin was now reading it with quiet fervour to Nerzhin. Rubin was no poet, but the lines he dashed off were sometimes clever and full of feeling. Not long ago, Gleb had praised highly the breadth of vision he had shown in a study in verse of Alyosha Karamazov, who appeared simultaneously in the overcoat of a white officer defending Perekop and in the overcoat of a Red Army man storming Perekop. Now, Rubin very much wanted Gleb to appreciate the Moses ballad and take to heart the message that waiting and believing for 40 years is rational, necessary, and essential. Rubin could not exist without friends. He suffocated without them. He found solitude so unbearable that he did not even allow his thoughts to ripen in his own head. As soon as he had so much as half a thought, he hastened to share it. He had been rich in friends all his life, but in prison it so happened that his friends did not share his views, and those who did were not his friends. No one in the acoustics laboratory was working then, as yet, except for the ever-blithe and busy Priantchikov, who had gotten over the memory of Moscow by night and his crazy journey, and was meditating a further improvement to his model, crooning, "Benzi, benzi, benzi, ba, benzi, 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 ba." At this point, Selivanovsky and Reutemann entered. Reutemann went on with what he was saying. In these voice prints, speech is visualized in three sets of measurements simultaneously. Frequency is registered transversely across the tape, duration lengthwise along the tape, and volume by the depth of the impression. By this means, every sound stands out as something so unique and original that it is easily identified, and you can even read back whatever has been said from the tape. Here we have—" He led Selivanovsky to the far end of the laboratory. "The VIR device, designed in our laboratory." Reutemann had forgotten himself that they had lifted it from an American journal. "And here," cautiously steering the deputy minister in the direction of the window, "is candidate in philological sciences Rubin, the only man in the Soviet Union who can read visually recorded speech." Rubin rose and bowed silently. As soon as Reutemann had pronounced the word voice print at the doorway, Rubin and Nerzhin had pricked up their ears. Their work, treated as a joke by most people, was emerging at last into the light of day. It took Reutemann 45 seconds to lead Selivanovsky to them, but with the Zek's unique quick-wittedness, They had realized at once that Rubin would have to demonstrate his skill in reading from voice prints. One of the regular speakers must read the text into the microphone, and Nyezhin was the only one present in the room. They also realized that, although Rubin really could read voice prints, he might slip up in an examination, and this must not be allowed to happen. It could mean a backward somersault into the netherworld of the camps. They understood each other at a glance.
"If you do it, and you can choose the sentence," Rubin whispered, "say, voice prints enable the deaf to use the telephone."
Nyezhin whispered in reply,
"If he gives me a sentence, you'll have to decipher it from the tape. If I smooth my hair, you're getting it right. If I straighten my tie, you're wrong."
That was where Rubin rose and silently bowed. Reutemann went on in that hesitant, self-deprecating voice of his, which you would have known without looking at him must belong to an intellectual. "Right, now Lev Grigorievich will demonstrate his skill. One of the speakers, say Gleb Vikentich, will go into the soundproof box and read a sentence into the microphone. The machine will record it, and Lev Grigorievich will try to decipher it." Standing one step away from the deputy minister, Nyezhin fixed him with an insolent gulag stare. "You want to think of a sentence?" he asked curtly.
"No, no,"
said Ivanovsky answered politely, avoiding his eyes.
"Make something up yourself."
Nyezhin obediently took a piece of paper, thought a moment, had an inspiration, and in the sudden hush handed what he had written to Selivanovsky in such a way that not even Reutemann could read it. "Voice prints enable the deaf to use the telephone."
"Is that really so?"
Selivanovsky asked in surprise.
"Yes." "Go ahead and read."
The apparatus began humming. Nyezhin went into the soundproof booth. How disgraceful the sackcloth curtain looked at that moment, that everlasting shortage of materials in the stores, and shut himself off from the eyes and ears of the world. The apparatus chattered, and 2 meters of damp tape, marked with inky streaks and smudges, were deposited on Rubin's desk. The whole lab stopped pretending to work and watched in suspense. Reutemann was obviously nervous. Nyezhin left the booth and watched Rubin impassively from a distance. Everybody else was standing. Rubin alone remained seated, giving them glimpses of his bald spot. Taking pity on his impatient audience, he made no attempt to hide his hieratic ritual, but quickly marked off sections of the still damp tape with the usual blunt copying pencil.
"You see, certain sounds can be deciphered without the least difficulty. The accented or sonorous vowels, for example. In the second word, the R sound is distinctly visible twice. In the first word, the accented sound of E, and in front of it a soft V, for there can't be a hard sound there. Before that is the formant A, but we mustn't forget that in the first, the secondary accented syllable O is also pronounced like A. But the vowel U or U retains its individuality even when it's far from the accent. Right here it has the characteristic low-frequency streak. The third sound of the first word is unquestionably U, and after it follows a palatal explosive consonant, most likely K. And so we have Ukov or Ukavi. And here is a hard V. It is clearly distinguished from the soft V, for it has no streak higher than 2,300 cycles. Vukovi. And then there is a resounding hard stop, and at the very end an attenuated vowel, and these together I can interpret as D. So we get Vukovidi. And we have to guess at the first sound, which is smeared. I could take it for an S if it weren't that the sense tells me it's a Z. And so, the first word is," and Rubin pronounced the word for voice prints, "Zvukovidi." He continued, "Now, in the second word, as I said, there are 2 R sounds, and apparently the regular verb ayet. But since it is in the plural, it is evidently ayut. Evidently razgravayut or razreshayut. And I'll find out which in a moment. Antonina Valerianovna, was it you who took the magnifying glass? Could I please have it a moment?"
The magnifying glass was quite unnecessary, as the apparatus made bold, broad marks. It was an old con spoof, and Nyezhin laughed quietly to himself. absently smoothing his already smoothed hair. Reuben gave him a fleeting glance and took the proffered magnifying glass. The general tension was growing, all the more so because nobody knew whether Reuben was guessing correctly so far. Selivanovsky was profoundly impressed.
"Amazing," he whispered. "Simply amazing."
Nobody noticed Lieutenant Schusterman tiptoeing into the room. He had no right to be there, so he kept his distance. He signaled to Nyezhin to hurry up, but instead of leaving the room with him, stayed behind, waiting for a chance to summon Reuben. He wanted to send Reuben to make his bed again, this time properly. It was not the first time that he had bullied Reuben with such readjustments. Meanwhile, Reuben had deciphered the word death and moved on. Reutemann was radiant. Not merely because he had a share in Reuben's triumph, but because he sincerely rejoiced in any practical success. At that point, Reuben happened to raise his eyes, encountered Schusterman's malignant scowl, realized why he was there, and bestowed on him a look of malicious glee, as if to say, "Straighten it yourself."
"The final word, telephone, we come across so frequently that I'm used to it and can recognize it immediately. And that's the whole thing."
"Astonishing," Selivanovsky said yet again.
"May I ask your name and patronymic?"
"Lev Grigorievich."
"Well then, Lev Grigorievich, can you identify individual vocal peculiarities from voice prints?"
"We call it individual speech type. As a matter of fact, that is precisely what we're working on at present."
"That's very lucky. I think we can find a job that may interest you."
Schusterman left on tiptoe.